Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, well, welcome back after the break. It's a pleasure to introduce Jean Rimbaud from Marseille, who will speak about the bounds of the homology of arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So homology or cohomology can be related to many things, like to spectral. Oh, yeah. Spectral theory, to geometry and topology. I think in this talk it will be more on the geometric and topological
side. Yes, so I'm going to talk about the smallest eigenvalue of the Laplacian on compact manifold, so it's zero. So there will be no explicit spectra in this talk. So there are, you can develop certain aspects of it in the direction of asymptotic distribution of spectra for the manifolds I'm going to discuss, but I'm not going to discuss this in this talk. So, and actually even I'm not going to talk much about homology. This will serve mostly as a motivation to use certain geometric results that I'm going to speak about in more detail. So let me start with a theorem, not about homology, but about just triangulation. So it's this theorem. So it's joint work with Nikolai and Sebastian. A bit later than that, from 2-3 years back. And it's Gozaevic, so I take X, a symmetric space, which maybe I'm going to explain very shortly what it is. So what is a symmetric space? There's a like differential geometric definition. I'm going to work more with an algebraic definition. It's G mod K with G, a semi-simple Lie group. And here you should think about, I guess, SLN. And K is a maximal compact subgroup. Compact, which is unique up to conjugacy, that's like undergraduate, and in this case it's SON. And okay, so this is maybe not very explicit, but like you know that for n equal 2, you get SL2 mod SO2. And so you can identify this with a hyperbolic half plane of Poincaré, because so this acts by homographies and this stabilizes the point I. So this is just the Poincaré half plane. And so in general, you know that on the Poincaré half plane, you have a metric of curvature minus one. And in general, you also get a metric on this G mod K because K is compact. It's a G invariant metric. It's more or less unique up to normalizations, and there are standard normalizations. And so this is a Riemannian manifold, which is very homogeneous since it has a Lie group as symmetric group. Okay, so I take one of these. So you should think like a hyperbolic plane or hyperbolic space if you're more familiar with it. And then there are some constants. Such that for any quotient, so for any gamma inside the group of isometries of X, so it's G in this case. Let me say something actually true. Positive isometries are connected, and it's the connected component of G. Maybe mod center, doesn't matter. Which is discrete and torsion-free. So we already saw these terms in Bram-Stoke. So discrete torsion-free means that the action on X as a subgroup of the isometries is discrete, means it's properly discontinuous. Orbits are discrete, and you can see around. Torsion-free means you get no singularities in the quotient. So the quotient is going to be an actual Riemannian manifold locally isometric to X. And the theorem is that you can triangulate this manifold if this is arithmetic with a number of simplices which is bounded by the volume with this constant. So let me say this precisely. Let me give a notation. So I call the quotient M. And I arithmetic. Well, I guess discrete is kind of unnecessary here. Let me say lattice. So yeah, discrete is kind of superfluous because arithmetic is discrete. So I have this arithmetic manifold, then M is homotopy equivalent. And I should change my choke. To a simplicial complex of degree at most B. So degree is just the number of simplices incident to every vertex. And there are at most A times volume vertices. Okay, so in words, what does this tell you? I take any manifold in this class defined by arithmetic lattices, which I'm not going to define right away. So we saw some examples in Bram's talk yesterday. And I will, at some point, I will actually need the definition, so I'll talk about this. But yeah, let me recall maybe the examples. So if G is SLNR, then, well, oops, it's in English. So a lot of the finite index subgroup of SLNZ are going to work. And the other example was given by, I'm not going to write it in detail, so the Bolza surface gives another example. So the holonomy of the Bolza surface is an arithmetic subgroup. So this was defined in Bram's talk, and yeah, I'm not going to redefine it, but I will actually give the definition later, so and use it. So if I have one of these, then I can basically triangulate it, so get a simplicial complex which is homotopy equivalent. So I put homotopy equivalent because in practice that's what we're going to want to do, and it's slightly simpler than doing that, but we can also do homeomorphic. It's just that it's more natural to do homotopy equivalent in this setting. Yep.
I'm not sure I know what is the degree.
Oh, yeah, so degree, let me define it in writing. So this means every vertex is an incident to at most B simplices. Every vertex incident to at most B simplices. So this is this is the local geometry of the complex. And so I have a complex which is locally very simple, boundedly simple, and globally I know that I have a number of vertices proportional to the volume. So I think this statement is, I mean, except for this part, this statement should be pretty clear. And now, so this is what I want to prove in this talk, explain how it works and why arithmeticity is important and how it is used. And the homology, so this statement almost immediately gives you bounds for the homology. Because, so you can use this simplicial complex to compute the homology of M. And well, because it has at most this number of simplices, of course, the homology is going to be of rank at most this. So, an immediate corollary. Is that there exists C such that for any arithmetic X manifold M, BI of M, well, let's say with coefficient in C, but yeah, in any field actually. Let me write F inferior to C volume of M. Okay, so these are the homology is bounded by the volume for arithmetic X manifold. And this is immediate because homology is basically a quotient of the F module spanned by this simplicism. Okay, does that make sense? Perfect. So this actually was known before. And I'll explain the difference between our result and this result, which is much weaker. So, but the nice thing about this result is that we also get bounds for the more complicated, for the other part. So like here I talk about homology with coefficients in a field, but I can also do homology over Z. So a less immediate corollary. In particular, so this does not use the degree, but this would use the degree, this part. So there exists, let's say, C prime, such that blah, blah, blah. So the logarithm okay, so like I said, so you can define homology as well with Z coefficients instead of over a field. And then you have a free part, so it's finitely generated abelian group. So you have a free part, which is basically read off by this with C. And you have a torsion part, which is a finite abelian group. So if you want to control the homology over Z, you need to control this for F equals C. And you need to control this size, and the bound is the same. Same size. So this is actually one of the main motivations for this, this theorem. Okay. And so I'm not going to discuss this, but it's basically some elementary linear algebra over Z. You need to have information, so the differentials are going to be very sparse because of the bound on degree. The complex is simply shown, so all the coefficients are plus or minus one. And so it's just a statement that the quotient of Z module of rank n by such matrices as at most exponential size in the rank of the module. Okay, so I'm not going to discuss homology much further. So if you have questions about the homology part of the talk, it's the right moment to ask them, I guess.
Maybe the first result, is it transform the seven samurai paper?
No, this is...
You said it was known before?
No, this is it's from Gromov, Balmav, Schön. Yeah, I will discuss a bit the history afterwards, because, I mean, basically, so they prove a weak version of that, and it's sufficient to do this. But yeah, maybe I'll not write this, but... So there are final results, so maybe I should discuss the sharpness of this. That makes sense. Is that the best that you can do? And the answer is kind of yes. So let me discuss this. So in general, it's the best that you can do. So I don't know a reference, but I think it was known for a long time that for Betti numbers, you can have linear growth in all degree for certain sequences. And for torsion, there's a really recent paper that gives a nice construction with exponential growth in all degrees where this is possible. So so it's sharp in general. Well, let me say for hyperbolic manifold. So Stepan Alexandrov. Constructed, so it's on the archive from last year. So sequences. So it's sequences of hyperbolic manifold. So in this case, all gamma n are going to be finite index subgroup in a fixed arithmetic lattice. Uh, to the finite index. No, I don't remember. Yeah, maybe. I mean, they're not cofinite, of course. Like they don't Benjamin-Isham converge. Actually, he proves even a bit more with. If I remember correctly, he even proved that a BI of MN with F2 coefficients goes to plus infinity. Oh, sorry. A bit better than that, divided by the volume of MN, does not go to zero. So in this case, he has exponential growth of F2 coefficients, and actually, this comes from torsion. Torsion classes. So we cannot hope to do better in the very general setting. But in many cases, actually, you can do better. So like Nani says, there are other results that are a bit better than this. And it's, I guess, so this is a seven people paper.
For
every I where this is possible. So it's these I's, I guess.
For every I, you construct the sequence, or you can
find
the sequence?
So we construct a sequence which works for every I. Yeah, the quantifier is, yeah. It's very short construction. It's not very complicated. You have to kind of start with enough things, and then he does a smart thing to get this. But so the thing is that it's a very specific construction, and we kind of expect that generically this does not happen. So I'm not going to state anything in this direction. But if you leave hyperbolic, just hyperbolic manifold, and you go to higher rank, then actually this does not happen. So if X is higher rank, let me say not a product to simplify the statement. You can do better than this, but I want to stay simple. Then there are actually then you cannot have so volume of wrong direction, I guess. For infinitely many. M for any delta. Except maybe well basically you understand everything. So if the space is higher rank, what happens is that you know exactly, you actually know the limit of BI divided by vol. And it's zero almost always, except when it's the middle dimension and you have some other condition that I'm not going to state. But so this result tells you that in a rank, this is not sharp, you can get better.
Sorry about the first result. You said that you want Benjamin-Isham converge. You mean
they don't have
Benjamin-Isham
converge
to the...
To HD.
Yeah, but they have a different
Benjamin-Isham. I don't remember if they converge to some normal cover or just it does not care about it. But I mean, they might have different limits. Like they have accumulation point, but they might not converge.
Okay, but anyway, if you take converging
subsequences,
the limit is not HD.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, this would be much more interesting if it was the case, but we expect that that if you converge Benjamin-Isham, this is true, but for torsion it's completely open. I said a few things, and there are a lot more results and mostly conjectures, especially about torsion, about what should happen. But I want to go more into the details of this result rather than discuss generalities. But feel free to ask questions if you want more precise statements. at some point. Okay. So I said I would do some history, so let me do that now. Okay, so yeah, maybe I should talk. So the plan now is to talk a bit about the history. Then I will talk about 16 decomposition and then about the a better version of 16 decomposition for arithmetic manifolds. That's kind of the main technical part of our paper. So the plan is so this is going to be very short. Second part is going to be the 16 decomposition. And third part is arithmetic Margulis lemma, or Collard lemma, let me say. Okay, so yeah, I think the part will be longer and longer, and maybe I won't have time to finish the last one, but hopefully I will get to explain something. So, so history, so like this kind of results was in the Balmav-Gromov-Schön book, so they proved something. So, Balmav. Gromov-Schön. So I guess it's like I never know how to attribute this because I think it's result of Gromov, but the write-up was done by all three, so I'll attribute it to all three. And so they prove exactly this result in more generality. So so they prove linear bounds for Betti numbers for all negatively curved manifold with necessary hypothesis. So let me say. Without Euclidean Durham factors. And curvature, so so here I just talked about symmetric spaces because that's the setting I want to use for this talk. But like I said, so symmetric spaces are Riemannian manifolds, and they are Riemannian manifolds with negative curvature. I mean, those symmetric spaces, like they're also compact ones that are positively curved, but yeah, so you have. I forgot some adjectives here, I guess. But so these symmetric spaces that I'm talking about enter in this setting. And so this is kind of the minimal hypothesis that you need for a theorem like this to hold, because there are fairly easy examples that contradict it if you remove any of them. And they prove that actually this works. So if you're bored, you can think about why there are these hypotheses. So this one is pretty clear. You just don't want to be able to scale the metric to have dumb things happen. This one is clear because if you have factors where curvature does not change when you renormalize, when you rescale, then of course you don't have any bounds with the volume. And this one is actually more subtle, but it's kind of related to this one. If you can do smooth example where you do kind of weird gluings along flat manifolds that cannot happen in the analytic category, and that's why they put this hypothesis. So they prove this, and the methods cannot give this. I will explain a bit. But of course, so this is from the differential geometric point of view, this is much more complicated than what we prove. Just the result is much weaker as well.
So the constant in the inequality depends on the curvature?
On the dimension. So the, yeah. Yeah, you don't care about the local geometry once you've fixed this. Yeah, I should maybe. This is very sloppy. It should be like a big O. This is a nice, so yeah, let me write it with a big O. This is maybe a big, bigger. Okay, so for torsion, there's a result with the same initials but different people. So it's Bader, Gelander, and Zauer. And this is much more recent, so this is like X's, and this is, I think, 2016 or maybe even later. And we prove basically the same result for torsion but with negative curvature. So here I rewrite it. This is really, you can have zero curvature along certain planes. Here, this is really with this condition. And here, you can drop the analyticity condition because you don't care about this phenomenon that comes from flats. So they gave the bounds bonds on torsion. So, basically the same bounds that I wrote here, except for general negatively curved manifold.
Here no analyticity?
No, because the analyticity, it's this phenomenon, you don't want to be able to glue weird metrics along totidiotic flat subspaces. I'm not super familiar, but actually they prove like a result with more geometric conditions that they use analyticity to rule out somehow. It looks weird, but actually it is a geometric condition. And it's implied a sufficient condition is also implied by strictly negative curvature. Okay, so what's the difference? So in our result that I erased, we can do like this for torsion, but we have to add the arithmeticity and locally symmetric assumptions. Okay, there are people who actually know about negatively curved manifold. I think like higher rank is not that far from symmetric, so maybe it's. I don't know about this, so I'm not going to discuss it. Also tell another result of Gelander. So I think in my result I put closed, and if I didn't, I should have, but it's true without closed, and the non-closed part is due to Gelander. The theorem about triangulation. So I'm not going to discuss the case of manifold with cusp because Tsarik Gelander did it 20 years ago now. And the techniques are very different. So in this part, almost everything in your theorem, in your proof of the theorem trivializes, but there are additional technical difficulties coming from the non-compacity, from the cusp, basically. So we have to do very different things, and it's completely disjoint from what we do. So I'm just going to assume this and deal with a closed case. Well, I guess with delta, it's finished now. Okay, so that's the short history, and there are other papers, but a lot of interesting papers, but I don't have the time to discuss them all. So, when did I start? Did I start at 10 or? Okay, so we have 30 minutes left. So let me start to discuss how to prove result about triangulation. So it's fairly well-known stuff, and I'm not going to discuss certain details, but I want to give an idea how you go from I want to reduce the topological statements to a geometric statement, and then so via 16 decomposition, and then I'll explain how to refine the 16 decomposition to get this statement. So let me do this. Any questions about the stuff so far? So, I mean, so far it was mostly fluff, but now it's going to get a bit more mathematical. So I'll do this in full generality for symmetric spaces. And this time I'll put the hypothesis without Euclidean factors or compact factors. So it's a G mod K for a G semisimple and K maximal compact. Okay, and M X manifold. So I take a quotient of X by a discrete torsion-free subgroup of G. So for this 16 decomposition, you don't need to assume anything about arithmeticity or even co-compacity or co-finiteness of gamma. And then for you define the thick part. So let me define the injectivity radius maybe. So let me give the three usual. If I take a point X, I have the injectivity radius. So maybe the more visual definition is so you expand the ball around your point, and the radius is the point where it's the radius, the injectivity radius is the radius where it starts to self-intersect. So you can define it as the maximal radius such that B of XR in M is isometric to B of some. So this is like the, probably if you've seen this, you've seen this picture. So this is in M, you have your point X. And then you, so you start, if you do a small ball, then it's a ball, and then at some point you start in self-intersecting, and this is when you say you've reached your injectivity radius. So. Okay, so this is kind of the definition you should think of. You can embed a large ball with this radius around the point, and you cannot go any further. And then it's so the maybe more useful definition when you work directly with the holonomies is the following. So it's the mean, I guess. Closed. So another way to see it, so you can say that once you've self-intersected, it's the same thing as getting a closed curve. You take the curve through X and the point of intersection, and then you go back with the other radius. And because of negative curvature, this closed curve actually is going to be essential, so non-trivial in the pi one, and it's the same thing. So this is a more like explicit definition, and then you interpret it with the holonomy. So the definition with which you work in practice is the following. Oh, sorry, I guess it's 1/2 here. So 1/2 because you go forth and back in the thing. So it's 1/2 times the mean of D of G x tilde for G gamma, that's the identity. So x tilde après image. Okay, so you leave this picture to the universal cover, and this means that you have here you have the x tilde, here you have the gx tilde, and because g is in the holonomy, these are the same ball, so it self intersects. Okay, so why did I define the integrity at a radius. So basically, so this is the part I don't think I'm going to have time to discuss, but if you have large interactivity radius, then you're fairly happy because you can, your manifold is very simple locally, so it's not going to be hard to triangulate it. And so the 16 decomposition is saying, is decomposing the manifold in a thick part, so the part where the injectivity radius is going to be large, in the sense larger than some fixed constant, and a thin part where it's smaller. And it's a theorem that says that actually if you choose the constant small enough, and you can choose it uniformly small enough, you are going to have a very simple thin part and a thick part. And the thick part can be complicated, but it's locally simple, so you're happy. So let me say that properly now. So 16 decomposition is this. So you have a thick part. So you take epsilon positive. So notation is very transparent, that's nice. So it's the set thick part is a set of points with a large injectivity radius, a thin part is the complement. So, and the theorem is that if you choose epsilon smaller than a constant depending only on x, then this is going to be a union of very simple components. So let me state it in the closed case so it's simpler. Theorem which is called Collard or Lemma or Margulis Lemma. So there exists a constant epsilon of x such that for every epsilon smaller than epsilon x, for every closed x manifold m, so the thin part. So we saw that in this interpretation of the injectivity radius, you see that somehow the thin part comes from small curves, essential curves. So the smallest curves are going to be geodesics. So in some sense, the thin part comes from closed geodesics. And this tells you that actually it comes from closed geodesics and you can read it off them. So it's a disjoint union. I mean, it is a union. Tubular neighborhoods. Of closed flats. So this picture is a bit misleading in the higher rank case because you can have more complicated local picture, but it's very accurate in the rank one case. So in the rank one case, the thin part is going to be exactly like this. And if you do differential geometry, it means negative curvature. If you do more algebra, it's rank one. And in a rank case, you can have intersecting flats, but in rank one, you have one-dimensional flats and they cannot intersect, so they're going to be disjoint. In the rank one case. So rank one, you should think about hyperbolic space. Okay. So this is a bit tautological, as I stated it, except for the part where they are disjoint. So let me give the actual algebraic version, which is much nicer to state in the higher rank case. So in rank one, I think in rank one it's pretty clear. Negative curvature. Thin part is really a union of tubes around geodesics. Now in higher rank, in higher rank, you have intersecting flats, and so you need to know a bit more to actually describe it. So, algebraic version. which is very useful in her range. And it tells you this, so for epsilon smaller than, I guess, 2, epsilon, or maybe 1/2, yeah, probably 1/2. For any so I replace manifolds with discrete subgroup of G. I don't need torsion free here. For any point, so let me call it X tilde, it's in the universal cover. So the algebraic version of being a neighborhood of a flat is being virtually nilpotent. So the subgroup generated by the elements in my discrete group which move X tilde of less than epsilon is virtually nilpotent. So this is the statement that's usually called the Margulis lemma. In the locally symmetric case, it's due to Zassenhaus, I think. And you can find the proof in full generality in the book by Balmain, Grove, and Schoen. But for symmetric spaces, it's much easier. Okay, so why did I give this statement? Because in the arithmetic version I'm going to describe later is going to be based on this, because it's much nicer to state. Okay, so this is 16 decomposition. And now, so this is a part that I'm not going to do very detailed, but so the way to go from geometry to topology is to take nets. So, so you fix epsilon smaller than epsilon of X. And then you take epsilon net in some, so you take M, a closed X manifold. You take an epsilon net in, not some, so because I fixed it, in M larger than epsilon, and I want to epsilon over 100, say. So I should say what this is, I guess. So a net is just you take a well-separated but sufficiently dense subspace. So you take S inside of this manifold, which is epsilon over 100 dense. So every point it at, is at a distance at most this from some point in S. And if I take two different points in S, the distance between them is at least epsilon over 200. So basically, you take points at random and with the condition that you cannot put two of them at more than this distance, at less than this distance, sorry. And when you cannot do it, you get something which is dense, so you get a net. And these two conditions together, somehow it's clear that they tell you that your net is kind of looks like the manifold. If you look on it, it's well, and so you can make combinatorial structure from it. So the standard construction is to do the nerve of this net. So so the nerve of this net. So it's going to say. I mean, it's also called the Ripps complex. Maybe this is a more familiar term, but in algebraic topology, they call it this. Well, not exactly. But so you, basically, you look at the ball of radius epsilon over 100 around all set of the point, and you put simplices according to the intersections. So if two balls intersect, if two points are at distance at most this, then you put an edge between them. If you have three points which are pairwise at distance less than this, then you put a triangle, etc. So you get a simplification complex, and if you do a picture, let me do a nicer case. So assume you've done your net kind of nice, like a honeycomb triangulation of Euclidean place. Then actually, if you do the distance properly, sorry, this is not very isometric, but it's fine, I guess. If you do this construction in this case, you should recover the triangulation that I draw in white. So you are going to get these triangles, etc. So there's a big theorem that tells you that under this condition, so here the fact that the fact that you are in the thick part tells you that these balls have a very simple pattern of intersection. All the intersections are going to be connected. So they are going to be contractible because they lift to the universal cover. And so there's a general theorem of algebraic topology that tells you that this nerve is homotopy equivalent to the space that it comes from. So theorem, this is homotopy equivalent to this thick part. Okay, so I recovered the thick part. And now I have 5 minutes to tell you how I do the rest, so that's a bit short, unfortunately. And then, because of the simplest nature of the thin part, you don't really care. It's not bad for 4-Betti number. So this part is okay because this is a net, so you have packing argument that tells you that this complex is bounded degree because of local geometry. The number of simplices is the right order because of separation properties and packing. And basically, for Betti numbers, you don't care about what comes from the thin part. But it's bad for triangulation because of the gluing maps. Because you know what the thin part is, you know what the thick part is, but then you have to glue them together, and you can do this in a pretty wild way. And this actually occurs, for example, if you know Dehn filling in dimension three, you can see that it gives you a contradiction to the theorem in the general case without arithmeticity. So I don't have time to explain it, but this is a this actually does happen that the gluing creates a lot of torsion in the homology and breaks the statement about torsion homology. Okay, so now the question is, what does arithmeticity give you? So I guess third part is arithmeticity. So arithmeticity gives you the means to actually not use the thick-thin decomposition, but incorporate everything in the part. So if you think about the closed case, here I said, okay, I triangulate the thick part and then I don't care about the rest, but I could have put my epsilon way below the Margulis constant according to the minimal injectivity radius on my manifold. Okay, I could go inside these tubes if I allow the radius to get very, very, very small. So the problem is then I don't have a uniform bound, so I don't get a bound for the number of simplices in this argument, and it's not good. So the point is that arithmeticity, you get lower bounds on the injectivity radius and upper bounds on the volume of the thin part, which allow you to actually say that you can do this. So let me just concentrate on the main technical result, which is upper bound on the volume of the thin part. So get triangulation from nets on the whole manifold. So we include the tubes in our netting process. So actually, we have to vary the epsilon, but that's not an issue. And then So we, because we take epsilon very small in the tubes, we need to control the volume, like I said, so we use this theorem. So this is the main technical result, and I'm going to try to use the last 10, 5 minutes, or 10, or 0. Two, okay. Okay, so I'm going to use them to state this theorem, I guess. Arithmetic lattice uniform with trace field K. So I need some arithmetic information about the manifold, and then I can take the quotient. Well, in this case, it works if it's an orbifold as well. And actually, I can put a lot more things here, but. Okay, so. Yeah, maybe let me write. So. Okay. So, so for arithmetic manifolds with trace field K, I get a big saving depending on the size, of the just the degree of K, for the volume of the thin part, from the volume of the whole manifold. And okay, to conclude from this, if you know a bit about arithmetic manifold, if you bound this degree, then actually you have a uniform bound on injectivity radius, so you don't need to do anything. And if you also have lower bound on injectivity radius depending on this degree, but it's very slowly decreasing. It's like 1/log. So this is much stronger than what you need to conclude by counting nets. And so let me just explain very shortly why is it K, and I won't have time to explain why arithmeticity is important for this result, but here arithmeticity really is necessary. Like, we cannot do this with so trace field is defined all the time for all lattices, and it's always a number field except in SL2R, but this result is false a priori. It is false, in fact. And so, yeah, maybe let me not write, but just so basically, K is the field from which you define the arithmetic lattice. So if your group is SLN R, the lattice is going to lie like in SU of a Hermitian form over K. And then you compare I should write this actually, at least. So we use the result of Breuillard in an exponential way. And maybe I'll stop here. So it's called the height gap in an exponential way. So the height gap tells us that basically we can do arithmetic Margulis with much larger tubes. Okay, I'll stop here.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.